From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Gideon Rachman. He's the chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times and former editor at The Economist, where he covered Asia and Europe. He joins us from VOA's studio in London. Gideon Rachman is the author of the recently published book, Easternization, Asia's Rise and America's Decline, from Obama to Trump and beyond. The book deals with the rise of Asia, the balance of power between China and its neighbors, and the decline of American global hegemony. Rachman argues that the rise of China is bringing to an end an era of American dominance in world affairs, a trend that began under President Barack Obama and continues, albeit for different reasons, under President Donald Trump. We'll talk with Gideon Rachman about the themes in his new book as we try to understand the underlying forces driving economic, fiscal, and political upheaval that threaten the West's global power. Gideon Rachman, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for trekking over to our studio in London. First, Gideon, define what you mean by Easternization.
Well, what I mean essentially is that over the last 40 years and more, we've seen an enormous burst of economic growth in Asia, very sustained, which has now really transformed the economic balance of power around the world, so that by 2014, for example, the IMF came up with a list of the four largest economies in the world measured by purchasing power, and three of the four biggest were in Asia, and the largest was, in fact, China, which was really quite a transformation from the era we all kind of grew up in when the US was number one. And what I look at in the book is how this economic shift is now changing international politics. And the argument essentially is that, as you explained in the introduction, that the period of American hegemony is coming to an end. It certainly hasn't ended in the sense that the US is still the most powerful country in the international system. But you can see and feel that things are changing with the rise of China. And within that central kind of conflict, if you like, between the US and China, there's a broader thing, which is a transition from Western power to Asian power, which is really a historic trend, because I think we've been for about 500 years in an era in which the West dominated the world, starting with the era of European colonialism, which began in the late 1400s, and then that transmitted from a period of European dominance to one of American dominance. And now with the rise of Asia economically, you're beginning to see the end of that period of Western domination of global affairs.
Gideon, didn't President Obama at least make a valiant play for the famous pivot or rebalance to Asia in the form of the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, which we know is now defunct? But he was kind of distracted by other events, or derailed by the cascade of events flowing from the Arab Spring, Tunisia, Egypt, of course, now the Syrian crisis. How would you evaluate that, at least that attempt by President Obama to acknowledge the rise of Asia?
Yeah, well, I think it was very significant in itself, because this was the first time, really, that you had had an American president, really during the whole history of the Republic, saying that Asia should be the centerpiece of American foreign policy, so that maybe in the early years with the Monroe Doctrine and so on, America was focused on its immediate neighborhood, on the Americas. And then in the 20th century, through the First, Second World Wars, the Cold War, Europe is really at the centerpiece of America's view of the world. But then I think Obama realizes correctly that some of those underlying economic trends that I discussed were changing the global balance of power. And so he says, rather controversially, that America needs to pivot. America needs to shift its foreign policy towards Asia. But in practice, it's a very difficult thing to do. I think the Obama pivot was based around two ideas. One was the growing economic power of Asia, but also the sense that, as he was a president who came in criticizing the Iraq War, and the idea was that America had spent too much time, effort, bloodshed in the Middle East, and that this was not the most important region of the world, that America should now focus above all on Asia, hence the pivot. However, in practice, a kind of historic irony happens that just as Obama is preparing to try to pull back from the Middle East, refocus further east on Asia, the Arab Spring blows up in 2011, and you have this cascade of events, the Egyptian Revolution, the overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi, and then, above all, the civil war in Syria, which mean that, in practice, a lot of the time and energy of the Obama White House is spent on this area that he'd been trying to downplay, the Middle East. Because as one of his team put it to me, the White House is about crisis management a lot of the time, and 90% of the crises happen to be in the Middle East. So I think Obama intellectually recognized that he needed to spend more time and energy on Asia, and he did a fair bit of it. You mentioned the TPP and the effort to try to get a whole new trade deal going. There's also an announcement that America's shifting military resources, in particular some of the Navy, towards the Pacific. But nonetheless, he keeps finding himself being dragged back towards the Middle East simply because it is so all-absorbing as a crisis.
Well, crises certainly haven't subsided in the Middle East, but we're now facing a crisis in Asia with the threat from North Korea, and we have now President Trump, who wants to so-called make America great again. He wants to basically revert back to looking more inward. He's not a fan of trade deals, we know. He wants to do one-on-one deals. He wants to get away from these multilateral deals like the TPP, which he sunk. And yet he needs China. We know from his visit with Xi Jinping here in the United States, and he realizes the key role that China plays in thwarting North Korea's nuclear ambitions. But now that we are under the Trump administration, Gideon Rachman, you wrote recently in the New York Times that you're concerned that Mr. Trump's China policies are likely to be counterproductive, damaging America's prosperity and even endangering its security while actually hastening the rise of China.
Well, I think that certainly the sinking, as he put it, of the TPP, which a decision he took on his first day in office, and to be fair, something he had campaigned on, so it wasn't exactly a surprise, but is potentially a blow to both America's economic and kind of geopolitical standing within the region. Economically, it was a new economic free trade area which was centered really around the United States and Japan, and therefore, in a sense, a counterpoint to the growing regional economic dominance of China. And I think Americans saw it as a way of kind of pushing back against that, but not just economically, also strategically, because as Shinzo Abe, the Japanese Prime Minister, said when he was visiting Washington to try and sell the TPP, he said the strategic importance of this deal is enormous. However, for Trump, and one has to remember Hillary Clinton also, rather slightly hypocritically, since she'd initially sponsored the TPP, came out against it during the campaign, because I think both candidates found that the anxiety about lost jobs, particularly in manufacturing, trumped, if I can use that phrase, all those other strategic and broader concerns about trade and investment flows. So I think getting rid of the TPP will be seen as a strategic error, although I think there are some in Asia who hope that eventually Trump may rebuild it. But I think the other thing that is a bit of a problem for America's standing is that America's allies are very anxious about exactly where Trump stands. They weren't, it has to be said, all ecstatic about Obama. Some of them felt that he had been a little too acquiescent, particularly in China's island building programs in the South China Sea. But nonetheless, the Obama administration's policies were pretty clear and pretty predictable. The thing about Trump is that, particularly on China, it's very, very hard to figure out what his priorities are and where they leave America's allies. So that you have in the campaign, as we discussed, this big focus on China's, what he calls his unfair trade. And then in the first month or so of the Trump administration, it looks like Trump is heading for a confrontation with China, not just on trade, but also on the South China Sea and indeed on Taiwan. So that sends out one set of signals to allies. And then you have Xi Jinping visiting Mar-a-Lago, and suddenly Trump saying that he has a wonderful relationship with the Chinese president and that he plans to make North Korea the centerpiece of the policy and that he's going to work very closely with the Chinese on North Korea, and that he stops calling China a currency manipulator, says they used to be, but they're not anymore. A lot of the trade stuff is downplayed for a moment. But I think if you're an observer like me, or more importantly, an American ally in Asia, you really don't know where he's coming from, you know, because he changes his tune so quickly. So if you took a snapshot now, you would say, well, things don't look too bad in US-Chinese relations, and they are working together on North Korea, and trade tensions have been dialed down. But Trump is so volatile that he could switch again, and you could have a sharp deterioration in relations with China, or frankly, if you're an ally like Japan, or a sort of tacit ally like Taiwan, you might be concerned that, well, if things get too warm between the US and China, might a Trump administration try to do a deal over the heads of the Taiwanese, over the heads of the Japanese and the Southeast Asians? I mean, all of these things are possible because Trump sends out such conflicting signals.
Well, indeed. And even if trade tensions have been dialed down, doesn't that bolster what is called RCEP, you know, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership deal, which was seen as sort of a counterpoint to the Trans-Pacific Partnership? So this RCEP being promoted by China, would that perhaps gain greater traction because the United States really needs China to help on North Korea? Could that be a quid pro quo, and what are the implications of that?
Well, I think RCEP is really more in the context of the ditching of the TPP, because as we discussed, the thing about the TPP was China wasn't a member. And the Chinese obviously noticed that and drew a certain conclusion, and they were trying to promote their own trade arrangement, this RCEP thing, which would include China and most of the economies of Southeast Asia. And now that was not as attractive a deal to many of these countries because it's a lower level deal. It doesn't provide the same degree of market access that the TPP would provide. For example, under the TPP, the Japanese would do quite a lot to open their agriculture markets, which they've traditionally been reluctant to do. However, if the TPP disappears, then if you're a country looking for new trade opportunities in the Asia Pacific, you then look for, well, the next best deal. And the next best deal probably is RCEP, which is being pushed quite hard by China, which centers around China and which does less in terms of services, but would lower tariff barriers in manufacturing. And you saw after Trump tore up the TPP, countries like Australia, which traditionally pretty close to America and which are signatories of the TPP, saying, well, you know, maybe we should look at RCEP now, look at it more seriously. And again, that would actually reinforce the trends that the TPP was in some ways pushing back against, because just through natural economic progress, you've seen China really becoming the center of the Asia-Pacific economies over the last 20 years and more, so that all of America's major security partners in Asia, so I'm thinking of South Korea, Japan, Australia, and some of the countries of Southeast Asia, all of them now have their most important trading relationship with China. And that creates a potential tension because they look to their security, their military protection to America, but their biggest economic partner is America's potential adversary, China. And how do they manage that? Now, one way to kind of get around that was to try to re-promote America's economic role in the region through the TPP. But if that falls to one side and RCEP is the new game in town, then that actually just simply reinforces the already existing trend towards a regional economy that is centered around China.
But what about the political implications of the rise of China's economic prowess, Gideon Rachman? For example, you know, it's an authoritarian regime, it's a mixture, a hybrid political model. And doesn't that then buttress or reinforce this more authoritarian, less democratic model? And if so, you know, what are the implications? We're already seeing populist revolts in the West, notwithstanding the recent French elections, a pro-European candidate. But we're seeing a revolt against an independent press with strong editorial oversight, the revolt against, you know, the trend toward globalization. These things underpin and exemplify the West's success. So how do you see, you know, that trend?
Well, I think that the Chinese have been very resistant to the idea the West has pushed with great energy and confidence after the fall of the Berlin Wall, that the whole world was eventually going to become democratic and that that would include China. And one has to remember that 1989 was not just the year of the fall of the Berlin Wall, but also the year of the Tiananmen Square massacre in China. And I think if you had said back then to people in the West, say in the White House or wherever, that, well, in 30 years' time, China's economy will have increased by some five times in size, but it will still be a one-party state run by the Communist Party. At the time of maximum democratic confidence, if I can put it that way, people would have said, no, that's impossible. You can't have a large, sophisticated modern economy and still be an authoritarian one-party state. Mm-hmm. And I think what the Chinese proved is that you can, at least for the moment, you can. Now the Chinese, I think, are serving as inspiration, if you like, for other countries or other regimes that do not want to yield to what they see as pressure to democratize. So that you had a wave of democratization in the 80s and 90s in Asia, countries like the Philippines, South Korea, for example, Indonesia, all moved from authoritarian regimes towards more democratic regimes. And that was partly because at the time there didn't really seem to be feasible alternatives to the democratic Western model, which was the time of the model of success. Now you have an alternative model, a Chinese model, which says you can actually have rapid economic growth and you don't have to become a democracy. And if you're an autocracy in Asia or elsewhere, well, that's kind of attractive. So you have countries such as Thailand, as an interesting example, which had been pretty close to America, but has had a military coup, has been very slow to restore democracy, resents the pressure from the United States to move back towards democracy, and so is moving closer to China, has just signed a big submarine deal, for example, with the Chinese. And these military deals tell you something about where people are looking to, for where their friends are in military terms. And actually, it also has a resonance for Africa, where in the 90s and more recently, the Americans and the kind of Washington-based institutions like the World Bank tried to make lending and aid increasingly conditional on moves towards democratic reforms. And what the Chinese did in countries such as Ethiopia was to come in and say, look, we're not really going to make a fuss about that stuff. We're interested in doing business deals. We'll provide big loans for infrastructure. Your internal politics are not something that we care about. And for the more authoritarian African countries and regimes, that was actually quite an attractive offer. If you combine it with the enormous investments that the Chinese were able to make with their proven track record of fast economic growth domestically and of getting infrastructure projects done overseas, suddenly there was an alternative Chinese model in Africa, which I think they've been quite successful in pushing.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Gideon Rachman. He's chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times and author of the recently published book, Easternization, Asia's Rise and America's Decline from Obama to Trump and Beyond. And he joins us from VOA's bureau in London. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Mohsin Riaz. He's from Islamabad, Pakistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Gideon Rachman. Well, Gideon, talking about this trend toward Easternization, and you were talking about Africa recently, I'd like to talk more about China's role in Africa. As you said, you know, many regimes prefer China. They don't attach strings to some of their aid and projects. They don't make condition of having an open political system or a free press. But this is a rather, I'd say, worrying trend, I think, for the United States. And when you talk to Africans across the continent, I think they prefer American influence. They prefer the American sort of way of doing business. But the Americans can't compete, it seems, with the Chinese.
Well, I mean, Africa's a big place, so I would guess you'll get a range of opinions. But I think it is true that the Chinese have been particularly adept at doing deals with regimes, with governments, particularly authoritarian governments that might not particularly want to have that kind of American pressure. Whether the people lower down the system necessarily will always thank the Chinese for doing deals, say, with the government of South Sudan or the government in Khartoum or other less savory regimes in Africa, you know, it's in a way, it's potentially something that could backfire. You've seen occasional anti-Chinese protests. There were some in Zambia a while back. So, you know, it's not like this is a record of unadulterated success, no setbacks for China. But I think you're right in the sense that if you have a very large economic offer to make, if you can offer markets and swift infrastructural development, that is quite an attractive offer. And I thought there was quite an interesting symbolic moment towards the end of the Obama administration when Obama went to Addis Ababa to address the Organization of African Unity. And the speech was in a way quite an emotional moment because obviously he was able to make the point that his father had been a Kenyan, that he had personal ties to the continent of Africa. And he received a very warm welcome, a standing ovation. But I couldn't help missing the symbolism, which is the fact the building he was talking in, the OAU building in Addis Ababa, had been built by the Chinese. When he drives in from the airport, he passes a very large industrial estate, which is full of Chinese-owned factories making clothing, shoes, a lot of the kind of lower-end manufacturing, which had been very profitable in southern China, but as wages have gone up, they've moved some of that to Africa. And so there was this contrast between the rather alluring political vision that Obama was able to present with the facts of Chinese investment. And that was, I think, quite a telling contrast.
Well, if U.S. economic and political influence is on the wane in Africa under the Obama administration, it certainly will be under the Trump administration, because Mr. Trump has projected or has actually offered to make cuts in the State Department and to aid or to other regions around the world. So this is going to be a major challenge. So the question to you is, you know, what is the role now for the United States in a U.S. administration that largely rejects globalization, multilateral trade deals in favor of these, you know, one-on-one deals? Can or should the United States assert itself to try to counter the rise of China? And if so, how, given these constraints?
Well, I don't think one should be too swift to write off the U.S. I mean, even though I am the author of a book called Eastonization about the challenge to American power, which is very real, but at the same time, America remains a very, very large market, which will continue to be attractive. It has enormous soft power. There are far more Africans, I would guess, who would want to emigrate to the United States than to China, and that is, you know, it's not something one should forget. And I think that there are major American multinationals. I mean, it's interesting that the State Department is now headed by Rex Tillerson, former boss of Exxon. Now, American oil firms are still very, very involved in Africa and all over the world. So it's not like America's kind of disappeared off the map. But I think that what's happened is that with the rise of China, you have a very, very serious competitor in Africa, even in the Americas, actually, where a country like Brazil, its major trading partner is now China, not the United States. You know, that needn't be a bad thing for all parties, really, because I think if you're an African country or a country in the Americas, even if you're quite well disposed to the United States, you might quite welcome the idea that you have a choice, you have a range of options, so that if the deal offered to you by the Trump administration is not an attractive one, well, maybe you can look to Beijing. But conversely, if the Chinese way of doing business is not attractive to you, and there have been critiques of it in Africa, for example, particularly the way in which Chinese companies have tended to bring in a lot of Chinese workers rather than employing people locally, well, if you get tired of that, it's not like the Chinese are the only offer. They're actually increasingly Japan, because it's quite concerned about the rise of China, is making much more of an effort itself in Africa and in the Americas. The Indian multinationals are rising. Indian mobile phone firms, for example, have done big deals in Africa and are looking increasingly to the Americas, to Europe. And then, of course, there are the traditional sources of investment, the Europeans, the Americans. So what's happened, I think, is that globalization is no longer synonymous with westernization. It's also now synonymous with the rise of Asia and indeed with the growth eventually of African multinationals who will start investing around the world.
That's a very good point. And let's not forget Turkey. Turkey has also made inroads into Africa.
I was just there yesterday. Actually, I got back from Istanbul yesterday, sure. Turkish construction firms in particular have been very important in North Africa and in the old kind of Turkish hinterland of, you know, the Turkic-speaking bits of Central Asia. So, yeah, I mean, I think that you are seeing a sense that a multinational is no longer synonymous with the word Western multinational. There are multinationals based all over the world, including Istanbul or indeed Lagos.
What about the rise of Russia? Gideon Rachman, you know, we're dealing with a resurgent Russia, having basically upended the post-Second World War order by invading a sovereign country, Ukraine, taking Crimea. We're seeing the rise of Russia as well. What do you say about Russia's role in this paradigm?
Well, I think there's a chapter on the book on Russia, in fact. There are a couple of things I'd say. First of all, they don't offer the same sort of economic challenge as the Chinese. And in that sense, their rise or re-rise, if you like, their attempt to recover some of the power they lost after the fall of the Berlin Wall, is not as securely based because it doesn't have this enormous economic engine behind it. However, the Russians have got some cards which they've leveraged very well. They're a huge military power. They're the world's second biggest, some would say biggest, nuclear weapons power, and they've used that nuclear threat quite overtly, actually. And they are a country that's also used to thinking in great power terms. They've been a member of the Security Council since 1945. They were, until 89, the other superpower. And they still behave like a global power, and in fact, rather more so than the Chinese. China's not yet in the mode of thinking as a global power. I think it very much aims to be the dominant regional power. Russia, even if it doesn't have the economic resources, still thinks as if it is a superpower. And that, in a way, sort of creates an expectation that Russia will play a global role. People look to it still. But I think the way that the Russians interpret their own destiny in the light of the rise of Asia is also changing, and in a rather interesting way. So that post-1989, say in the 1990s in particular, I think many Russians' intelligentsia basically thought, look, our system has kind of failed. The successful system is the West. And therefore, what we should look to do is try to converge with Europe, perhaps maybe one day join the European Union, maybe even join NATO, that we should adopt their kinds of ways of doing things. But then as Russian anger towards the West mounted for reasons we don't have time to go into, but they begin to feel that the West is antagonistic towards them. We certainly feel that antagonism from Moscow post Ukraine and Georgia. The Russians begin to sort of intellectually move away from the idea of convergence on the West and rediscover the idea of Russia as a partly Asian nation. And indeed, two-thirds of the country lies within Asia. They have this huge Asian hinterland, and Russian intellectuals who belong to the kind of Eurasian school will tell you that, well, maybe now we shouldn't have neglected the intellectual roots of a distinctive Russian identity which has a very Asian element to it. They'll point to the role of the Mongols centuries back in settling Russia and imposing cultural patterns which may persist to this day. And some of them will say, well, look, actually Europe is in decline, China's on the rise, so why are we always looking west? Should we perhaps look east as well? And you see an effort in Russia now to create a kind of new special relationship with China, partly as a recognition of the growing power of China, but also, I think, because they feel they're the two major anti-Western powers, the two countries that are holding out against the West's efforts, the kind of things we were talking about earlier, to, as they would see it, impose or spread democracy around the world. And so Putin and Xi Jinping and Russia and China have discovered a shared interest in pushing back against westernization and, frankly, against American power.
Well, as we close, Gideon Rachman, I suppose nobody's against or necessarily opposed to this concept of Easternization, but I think what some people worry about are the political implications thereof, you know, authoritarian regimes, strongmen, where the United States and the West, at least history shows us, have been able to combine both, you know, market forces and democracy, or at least an open system. So that leads me to ask you, you know, is this shift toward Easternization an inevitable result of globalization or an outgrowth of specific failures of the Euro-Atlantic West?
Look, I think you can always point to your own failures, but I actually would incline to the inevitability school. I do think that once Asian countries, and in particular China and India, discovered the formula for rapid industrialization, and as long as the West kept its markets open, which I don't think was a mistake, then if you get countries of that size growing at 8 to 9%, they will, and now have become, major, major global economies, and that will inevitably have political implications. However, the bit that I don't think is inevitable is the idea that Easternization need necessarily be synonymous with authoritarianism. I think it is at the moment, because China is the center of this phenomenon. It's the most powerful economy in Asia, and it is an authoritarian country. But there are other Asian countries, Japan, major economy, but also perhaps most significantly in the long run, India, which is another country of over a billion people growing rapidly, 7-8% a year, that is a democracy, that doesn't accept the idea that Asian values and Easternization should be synonymous with a backlash against democratization. And I think the argument isn't actually over in China either. There are pro-democracy forces, liberal forces, that are, you know, not having a great time of it right now, but you can see them, for example, in Hong Kong, and indeed within the Chinese mainland. So I think even within China, there were many people who would hail the rise of China, who would hail Easternization, but who would very much reject the idea that that means that that's all up for democracy in Asia or around the world. I don't think Easternization need necessarily be synonymous with a rollback of political freedom.
The book is Easternization, Asia's Rise and America's Decline, from Obama to Trump and beyond. The author, Gideon Rachman. He is also chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times. Gideon Rachman, thank you for joining us at our VOA London Bureau and for your keen insights. Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington and London. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest and to Rebecca Ward for her technical assistance. Our director was Celia Lopez. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.